So, Leute. Scheiß auf Dune. Im Besenwagen läuft im Winter 2025 die Teamchef-Trilogie. Mit Grisha von Wismar haben wir angefangen. Letzte Woche Jana Seel von UAE und diese Woche kommt der neue Kopf vom Sport bei Red Bull Bora vorbei. Besenwagen fährt also heute mit dir nach Mallorca und Paul Voss wartet da schon auf uns. Zusammen überlegen wir uns dann, welche deutschen Begriffe gibt es noch für mallorquinische Wörter. Also, erstmal danke fürs Einsteigen, schnall dich an. Mein Name ist Bastian Marx.
Hola, mein Name ist Paul Voss.
Und meine Andi Stauf.
Nächste Runde, Trainingrunde, gesponsert von...
So, wir sind heute hier in diesen Call reingegangen und meine initiale Vermutung war, dass Fossi neben einem riesen Kühlschrank sitzt, weil es so gebrummt hat. Aber dann hat er hier was in die Kamera gehalten und was war's? Eine Blackroll-Massagepistole, eine schwarze, was natürlich meine Verwunderung gelüftet hat.
Genau, also ich reise tatsächlich immer mit dieser Fascia Gunner, also mit der Massagepistole von Blackroll plus meine Recovery Boots von Blackroll. Also bin komplett ausgestattet, ja, und vor der Aufnahme saß ich noch mit nackten Beinen hier und habe mich schön massiert.
Eine traumhafte Vorstellung. Wer sich das Ding auch gewünscht hat zu einem Fest, was vielleicht bald ansteht, ist meine Freundin. Also ich glaube, ich muss da demnächst auch mal auf die Seite und dieses Teil bestellen.
Ja, nicht nur Paul Voss kann das Ding empfehlen, sondern auch Stiftung Warentest. Da wurde die Fascia Gun von Blackroll nämlich Testsieger. Und wenn ihr euch jetzt auch so ein Ding nach Hause bestellen wollt oder eure Liebste damit beglücken wollt, dann könnt ihr das machen mit dem Code Besenwagen. Gibt es nämlich alles groß geschrieben, gibt es 10% Rabatt auf alle Produkte außer den Sale auf blackroll.com.
Und da gibt es auf jeden Fall noch ein paar andere interessante Sachen, mit denen es euch besser gehen wird. Also blackroll.com und Code Besenwagen, das Ganze nochmal bei uns in den Shownotes.
Jungs, was geht?
Ja, Paul, was geht bei dir? Du bist Mallorca.
Ja, ich habe mich auf die, ich könnte so richtig deutsch sein, auf die 17. Insel, nee, auf die 17. Bundesland.
Ja, wir ziehen das jetzt heute mal durch. Das ist Thema der Folge hier, eines der Themen der Folge.
Ja, ich habe mich nach Malle verzogen.
Kannst du uns noch so ein bisschen mitnehmen in den Entscheidungsprozess, weil also die Destinationenliste, die du hier die letzten Wochen immer wieder mal preisgegeben hast, die war ja sehr lang. Also man hätte ja wirklich schon eine Europa-Tour daraus machen können. Europa-Afrika-Tour.
Genau, aber da ging es eigentlich da ging es immer um Januar. Aber für Dezember ist also ganz ehrlich, ne, du steigst halt irgendwo in Deutschland in einen Flieger, da fliegt zweimal am Tag irgendwie so ein Flieger hier nach Malle.
Das mindestens ist relativ günstig. Zweimal am Tag.
Ja, und also weiß ich nicht, ne, also ich würde jetzt sagen, man steigt aus und ist relativ schnell auf dem Fahrrad, war gestern nicht so der Fall, ich bin Dienstagabend hier gelandet und ich habe anderthalb Stunden am Flughafen gebraucht, bis ich endlich beim Mietwagen war. Also ich brauchte auch Mietwagen, weil ich hier im Niemandsland bin gerade. Aber ja, bin jetzt hier, schön, ne? Also Straßen sind noch da, ja, ist alt wie immer.
Also als man früher noch nicht so über den Klimawandel und so weiter nachgedacht hat, da gab es ja auch auf jeden Fall die Stories, dass der eine oder andere Radprofi mal sich morgens früh in den Flieger gesetzt hat, wenn das Wetter schlecht war, auf Mallorca eine Runde gefahren ist und dann abends wieder zurückgeflogen ist. Ja, das war so, glaube ich, zu Hochzeiten der Billigflieger.
Das habe ich noch nicht gehört.
Ist das wirklich passiert oder sind es einfach Gerüchte?
Ich habe es nicht gemacht. Ich habe es nur gehört, dass es vorgekommen ist oder zumindest mal für so ein, zwei Tage dann, wenn du halt ein Rad auf Mallorca stehen hast, dann ist es ja auch echt ziemlich easy, ne?
Aber deutsche Radprofis?
Ja, natürlich
deutsche. Also sagen wir mal so, ich kenne auch Leute, die das in der ähnlichen Frequenz heute noch eventuell machen. So würde ich es nicht machen. Also das ist mir jetzt, also ganz ehrlich, da fahre ich lieber zwei Tage jetzt gerade in Düsseldorf durch die Schiffe, als mich da. Also ich finde jetzt Fliegen auch nicht so geil. Also nicht so, dass ich mich da reinsetze und
nee, Spaß das bin ist und schon so. Immer ein Aufwand mit diesem Fahrrad da.
Ja. Aber wie auch immer. Die Lösung dafür, einfach Private Jet Sponsor.
Jo.
Ja.
Wir haben's. Genau, das ist die Lösung.
Oder selber einen Flugschein machen und selber fliegen.
Ja.
Ja, brauchst immer noch einen Jet.
Kannst du mieten.
Aber wir wollten ja, du hast am Anfang, als wir noch im Off waren, hast du mich gefragt, ob ich da und da schon lang gefahren bin.
Erklär ja, mal also kurz. Paul Voss eingecheckt, jetzt irgendwo bei Arta, wir werden es jetzt nicht genauer benennen, aber da ist er auf jeden Fall nicht, aber irgendwo dort. Und ich habe dich gefragt, warst du schon oder willst du noch Orangenthal fahren? Ist nämlich nicht weit von da. Hat Fossi nichts gesagt, dieser Begriff? Kennst du echt nicht?
Nee, Mann, also.
Aber Peter Maffaytal kennst du?
Diese ja, ganzen. Peter Maffaytal ist. Also, erstmal war ich schon ewig nicht mehr auf Mallorca Radfahren. Und so diese ganzen Begriffe, so eingedeutscht, die es früher gab, so, die habe ich auch irgendwann nicht mehr benutzt, weil ich eigentlich immer nur noch mit Locals dann gefahren bin. Also, Andreas Klier zum Beispiel war ja damals oder ist immer noch Local, also wohnt ja auf Mallorca schon ewig. Und da gab es ja zu der Zeit auch noch zwei aktive mallorquinische Radprofis, mit denen man dann so unterwegs war. Und also da waren diese deutschen Begriffe dann auch nicht mehr in Verwendung. Aber so ein paar sind natürlich noch übrig geblieben. Also mein erstes Mallorca-Erlebnis war wahrscheinlich so erstes Jahr U19 Nationalmannschaft Trainingslager, damals noch mit Helmut Taute als Trainer, der dann immer die Streckenbeschreibung morgens angesagt hat mit einem sehr schönen ostdeutschen Dialekt. Und dann kamen da so Begriffe zum ersten Mal auf. Also die tote Stadt zum Beispiel, die heute, glaube ich, alles andere als tot ist. Aber damals war früher, vor allem in den Wintermonaten, da wirklich gar nichts los. Und es war wie ausgestorben.
Ich glaube, da ist jetzt auch noch nicht viel los.
Sarapida. Ja, kennt man wahrscheinlich, glaub, wenn man mal auf Mallorca Rad gefahren ist, aber da gibt es ja noch ein paar Begriffe immer, auf jeden Fall.
Da gibt es auch immer jedes Jahr im Frühjahr ein Rennen. Und also wenn man Bock hat, auch die mallorquinischen Krankenhäuser kennenzulernen, sollte man dem Rennen teilnehmen. Mhm. Da, die Chance ist relativ hoch,
dass
du einen Krankenwagen siehst oder das Krankenhaus sogar.
Regelmäßig durchs Orangental.
Und wo ist das Orangental jetzt?
So rechts von Petra. Ich versuche es gerade zu finden und dir ein Segment oder so zu schicken.
Rechts von Petra.
Ja, da gibt es noch, ne, was gibt es noch? Tankstelle kennt ja jeder.
Tankstelle.
Muss man ja mittlerweile auch Schlange stehen.
Hier den steht sogar auf Strava steht sogar Orangenthal.
Echt? Hast du wahrscheinlich angelegt, oder?
Ich schicke euch das Segment. Also das Segment heißt nicht Orangenthal, aber auf der Karte von Strava steht Orangenthal.
Okay. Soldatenberg gab es auch noch.
Stimmt. Datenberg ist auch noch ein gutes Wort.
Den gibt's auch.
Also noch? Schickt uns bitte solche Begriffe. Welche fallen euch noch ein? Deutsche Mallorca-Begriffe.
Ja.
17. Bundeslandbezeichnungen.
Delta. Zählt das?
Naja.
Warum heißt Delta eigentlich Delta?
Weil da früher ein Hotel Delta stand, Paul.
Okay.
Oben. Und deswegen
sehr gut.
Hat man es irgendwie Delta genannt. Okay.
Verstehe. So, dann hoffen wir, dass jetzt die Leute noch nicht alle abgeschaltet haben und vielleicht ist noch jemand da.
Ja, was gibt's noch für?
Dann können wir mal über...
Paul, wann warst du eigentlich das erste Mal auf Mallorca Radfahren?
Relativ spät, in den Junioren war das.
Aber kannst du dich noch dran erinnern, an die alten Straßen? So bevor eigentlich diese krasse Infrastruktur da aufgefahren wurde und alle... So, zumindest mal die ganzen Orte, die großen Verbindungsstraßen jetzt, die es heute so gibt, die gab es ja damals alle nicht.
Genau, also ich kenne das nur so, das erste Mal war ich hier mit meinem Verein damals, PSV Rostock in Paguera und sind halt da immer rumgefahren vor allen Dingen, ne? Also relativ selten dann rüber auf die Ostseite. Und ich weiß noch, wie ich irgendwann nochmal auf Malle war, irgendwie so wirklich einige später und bin ich mit Schulle und Radochla hier rumgefahren. die waren ja zur damaligen Zeit, gab es zwei Handys, aber du hast noch nicht so, also Komoot und Strava gab es halt nicht so richtig. Du musstest halt wirklich mit der Karte irgendwie planen, du musstest die Wege kennen. Und ich bin dann immer noch so gefahren, wie ich es aus dem Kopf kannte, aus den vorigen Trainingslagern. Und die haben mir aber eine ganz neue Welt gezeigt. Weil die sind dann diese ganzen Routen ab. Ich glaube auch, dass wegen denen gibt es diese Fahrradstraßen durch Mallorca. Die Schilder überall mit diesen Fahrradsymbolen drauf, die stehen da, wo Radochla und Schulle die Wege gemacht haben. Irgendwann sind da so viele rumgegangen, weil die immer mehr Deutsche mitgenommen haben und das hat sich dann so rumgesprochen. Auf einmal wurden diese kleinen Straßen immer mehr befahren von Radfahrenden. Und das,
davon gibt es aber noch geheimere Wege. Die bin ich damals mit Andreas Klier gefahren. Und da hast du dann auch wirklich auf einmal nur noch Mallorquiner getroffen. Also da waren keine Radfahrer mehr unterwegs, die irgendwie von woanders kamen. Und ich habe auch schon ein paar Mal danach nach diesen Straßen gesucht und ich habe die auch einfach teilweise nicht mehr gefunden. Die sind einfach weg. Aber
die gibt es auch nicht mehr, ne?
Doch, glaube ich schon. Ein paar schon, auf jeden Fall.
Ey, Basti, das Orangental ist ja richtig steil.
Ja, da gibt es einen Berg raus. Also das Orangental geht auch in die andere Richtung noch weiter. Da ist auch noch ein Berg, aber da, von da aus kannst du reinfahren, auf jeden Fall. Fahr mal durch, das ist großartig. Nur wenn es gerade frisch geschifft hat, ist es überschwemmt.
Dann mache ich das morgen mal direkt.
Ja.
Ey, das ist ja hier bei mir, das ist bei mir direkt um die Ecke.
Ja, ich sag's doch.
Okay, nice.
Sonst hatte ich jetzt eigentlich das Gefühl, dass Mallorca so ein bisschen an Stellenwert verloren hat, zumindest mal unter den professionellen Radfahrern. Also so ein paar Deutsche fahren da gerade noch rum. Aber ich finde es wirklich krass, wie viele mittlerweile so diese Costa, was ist das dann, Blanca-Geschichte machen. Mit Calpe, Denia, wo eigentlich früher immer hauptsächlich so die Benelux-Fraktion vertreten war. Da sind ja wirklich mittlerweile alle.
Ich weiß den Grund. Du hast längere Anstiege, also du kannst in kürzerer Zeit mehr Höhenmeter fahren und vor allen Dingen kannst du, du hast diese Schattenberge nicht so wie auf Malle und du kannst auch viel besser Tests fahren, all solche Dinge. Das kannst du auf Malle ja, kannst ja nicht knicken. Wenn du, da gibt es eigentlich hier nur wirklich den Putsch so richtig. Und der Rest hat ja einfach jetzt gerade mit dem Schatten und so, ist viel zu rutschig, um da auch mal länger am Stück richtig schnell zu fahren. Früher, also als wir noch Profis waren, sind wir so langsam berghoch gefahren, da war das alles gar kein Problem.
Aber jetzt,
kannst ja, also da macht ja gar keinen Spaß.
Ja. Gut, ich finde es trotzdem nicht so schön. Ich würde immer noch auf Mallorca machen.
Ey, ich bin da jetzt also, ne, das erste Mal
sofort.
Demnächst. In zwei Wochen. Rockets Trainingslager in Altea. Gucke ich mir mal an. Mal gucken, wie diese Gegend so aussieht.
Das Rad nimmst du natürlich mit, ne?
Klar. hier was anderes. Mir wurde ans Herz gelegt, auf YouTube die Doku über die Familie Kunz zu gucken. Hat das schon mal einer gesehen?
Welche
also, Familie? Familie Kunz. Hanna Kunz wird dir wahrscheinlich was sagen. Mhm. Fährt bei UAE im Devo-Team.
Ist sie aus Kölner Raum?
Nee, die sind so aus der Pfalz.
Weil ich habe heute irgend von Lynn Teutenberg irgendein Foto gepostet mit einer UAE-Fahrerin, mit Nils und ihrem Bruder.
Ja, das könnte ja vielleicht Magda Leis gewesen sein. Man weiß es nicht.
Ach so, ich kenne mich ja nicht so aus. Okay. Ja.
Familie Kunz. Guckt euch das an. Also, es wurde mir mit dem Begriff Wholesome ans Herz gelegt, diese YouTube-Doku zu gucken. Ist vom SR oder vom SWR oder so. Familie Kunz, Mutter, Vater und 10 Kinder. Und alle machen Radsport. Die sind einfach, diese Doku, leider wird irgendwie in dieser Doku nicht beantwortet, wie kommen die eigentlich zum Radsport. Es wird einfach nur ein Tag beleuchtet und zwar Silberpilzpreis Bellheim. Also der Pfalz-Klassiker, 200 Kilometer und die ganze Familie fährt mit. Also es sind natürlich ein paar von den Kindern sind noch zu klein und ein paar sind Mechaniker, aber schon einer von den ganz kleinen Jungs fährt das Kinderrennen, dann die kleine Schwester von Hanna, von noch ein kleiner Bruder von Hanna, ich glaube 5 Kinder oder so insgesamt fahren bei diesen Rennen mit. Hanna gewinnt auch das Frauenrennen und dann wird noch so ein bisschen die kleine Schwester von ihr ist ultra ehrgeizig, die wird dann auch irgendwie so zumindest irgendwie so die Bundesliga Cross oder was, Cyclocross gewinnt sie dann noch in dieser Doku und die Mutter und Vater sind immer dabei und die haben einen Bauernhof und wie die das alles sind, keine Ahnung, aber guckt euch an, ist auf jeden Fall einfach nur wholesome, wie diese Familie das abspult mit Pfälzer Dialekt.
Tja. Gab es auf jeden Fall ein paar in der Pfalz, das war dann nicht immer so alles eine Familie, aber so Familienzweige. wo dann so Onkel, Tanten alle gefahren sind. Da bist du, also da hattest du wahrscheinlich irgendwann eine größere Wahrscheinlichkeit, mit irgendeinem Familienmitglied von diesen Radsport-Clans aus Rheinland-Pfalz dann zusammenzufahren, als mit einem Teamkollegen.
Wir haben das geguckt abends, am nächsten Tag hatte Wilma eine Vertretungsstunde in der Schule und hat den Kindern einfach diese Doku angemacht, die meinte, die waren hin und weg.
Die haben es auch angerannt.
Die haben sich so, alle konnten sich mit einem von diesen Kindern identifizieren und so und haben das so voll gebannt geguckt und dann noch so von ihren eigenen Sportarten erzählt und so weiter nachher und auf jeden Fall kam also, gut an.
Meine Mutter hat ja auch relativ viele Geschwister und von der sind auch, glaube ich, 4 oder 5 auch noch gefahren damals. Also die
hatten
auch immer das Auto gut zugepackt. Ich glaube 12.
What the fuck? Ernsthaft? 12 Geschwister?
Das war noch eine andere Zeit.
Ja, aber ich glaube, war schon immer ein bisschen assi.
Ja, aber 12?
Ja. Ich kenne noch nicht mal alle. Also den 13. Namen, den habe ich erst vor 2 Jahren oder so zum ersten Mal gehört.
So lange hat es gedauert, die anderen kennenzulernen.
Jetzt mal ohne Mist, stell dir vor, du bist als Kind zu Hause mit zwölf anderen Geschwistern.
Ja, ich glaube, die waren nicht alle zeitgleich zu Hause, ne? Das ging
ja gut,
schon
aber trotzdem, also, aber, ja gut. Also wenn wir mal 12 Jahre Abstand gewesen sein, hoffe ich mal. Alle Gummier, ey. Krass, ey. Na gut.
Ja, ich spreche das nächste Thema nicht an.
Ach so, ja, Basti ist offiziell Influencer.
Ach so. Endlich geschafft.
Nie probiert, doch geschafft.
Ja,
Basti, ich dachte, das wäre eine Fotomontage, dass sie einfach so deinen
Account
dahin eingebastelt haben.
Ich dachte ja, es wäre ja noch mehr als eine Fotomontage. Ich dachte ja, es wäre Scam.
Also, ich muss jetzt hier ein bisschen erklären.
Ja, erklär mal, Basti.
Also, was ist passiert? erstmal Maurice Baderstedt mir irgendwann vor 2 Wochen, es ist noch nicht mal 2 Wochen her, vor einer Woche oder so geschrieben, ey, hier, ich bin nominiert für so einen Influencer-Preis von Sport, Cycling-Kategorie irgendwie, ich muss nach München und so, top. Ja, also hat er mir halt als seinem Verbindungsmann bei Rose gesagt, um halt zu sagen, so was da für eine gute Arbeit macht hier als Influencer. Ja, top, alles klar, spitze. 2 Tage später schickt mir unser Redakteur, leitet mir eine E-Mail weiter von unserer Kontakt-E-Mail-Adresse, Besenwagen, wo das Gleiche drin steht. Ich wäre nominiert für irgendeine Cycling-Influencer-Kategorie bei dieser Veranstaltung in München. Ich habe das gelesen und dachte einfach, 100% Scam. Balle hat mir schon dasselbe erzählt. Ich dachte erstmal so, Balle, Idiot, auf Scam reingefallen. Draufgeklickt wahrscheinlich. War so, ja, hier zum Anmelden, klick so ungefähr, ne? Mit Link. Direkt gelöscht oder halt komplett ignoriert. Ja, turns out, Baller war da und wir waren tatsächlich beide in derselben Kategorie nominiert und es ging irgendwie um Sport-Influencer-Award in der Kategorie Cycling und Engagement. Ich war Top 3.
Herzlichen Glückwunsch.
Danke. Ja, wahrscheinlich, wenn ich da gewesen wäre, hätte ich wahrscheinlich 25.000 Euro gewonnen oder so, aber...
Ja, also ab jetzt bist du nur noch der Gumo-Influencer.
Ja, ich habe einen riesen Einfluss auf
aber die Szene. Wenn du jetzt da gewesen wärst, hätte ich vielleicht...
Mach das doch Vollzeit jetzt einfach.
Ja.
Das hätte
mit so einem Preis kann man das richtig machen, oder?
Zu deinem gelben Ferrari.
Ja, ich habe einen gelben Ferrari-Pulli.
Nee, ist Lambo? Willst du ein Lambo?
Ich will ein lila Lambo, will ich.
Stimmt, lila Lambo war das. Mhm. Entschuldigung. Ich habe mich jetzt gerade mit Ulf Porsche verwechselt. Entschuldigung.
Ja. Aber Jan Kuhn, beziehungsweise Jan Kuhns Freundin, hat mir einen gelben Ferrari-Pulli geschenkt. Den kannst du zur nächsten Aufnahme, zieh ich den mal an.
Ja, bitte. Wir bitten mit rum.
Der ist großartig, wirklich. Ja. Ja, also, wie gesagt, nie probiert, aber doch geschafft. Influencer, Top, Podium, Influencer-Podium. Messe München. Übrigens, Entschuldigung, ISPO München, tut mir leid, dass ich eure Mail für Scam gehalten habe.
Aber das würde mich jetzt, aber ich hätte es trotzdem.
Internetführerschein, sage ich nur.
Ist das in der Kategorie, ist das in der Kategorie Cycling?
Ja.
Also, aber da gibt es ja die Fahrradmaus, wie sie alle heißen. Dann ja,
keiner hat so viel Engagement wie ich.
Basti, der hat mehr Engagement als die Fahrradmaus, ganz klar.
Können die sich warm anziehen?
Kai Pflaume, ja, auch aus, auf Platz XY ja, verdrängt.
Wenn du 600.000 Follower hast und dann nur 50.000 mit dir interagieren, ist halt nichts.
Ich glaube, Rick Zabel ist größer als die Radsport-Bubble. Der ist schon so ein richtiger Influencer.
Ja. Der ist schon eine eigene Bubble.
Fährt er auch
nicht
so viel Fahrrad.
Wen interessiert es am Ende? Wen interessiert es? Lass mal Radsport jetzt. Rick Zabels, Ex-Teamkollege, Binyam Gemay, waren die noch? Nee, die sind jetzt neu, während die Teamkollegen. So rum ist es nämlich.
So rum,
ja. So rum ist es nämlich. Endlich, was schon lange gekocht wurde, wurde jetzt aufgetischt. Binyam Gemay, offiziell Wechsel zu NSN, formerly known as Israel Premier Tech.
Habe ich die Story schon erzählt? Hat sich mal den damaligen Sportchef da von der Mannschaft drauf angesprochen habe, was, ob der jetzt bleibt oder ob der geht, und der so völlig erstaunt war, dass das überhaupt zur Debatte steht. Ich hatte kurz vorher dieses Gerücht aufgeschnappt und habe ihn dann so einfach gefragt, also ist ja auch für uns wissenswert, ob so ein Fahrer in der Mannschaft bleibt oder nicht. Wir hatten ja in der Intermarché-Mannschaft damals auch mit Georg Zimmermann und Jonas Rutsch zwei Fahrer, und beide sind ja auch oft mit Gemay unterwegs. Deswegen wollte ich einfach mal so nachhören, wie da so die Lage ist. Und ich glaube, bis zu dem Zeitpunkt wusste der noch nichts. Und ja, turns out, der ist jetzt wirklich weg. Sorry.
Aber ja, blöd gelaufen.
Wer geht ist auch da ganz der alleine, ne? Also er nimmt jetzt irgendwie keinen von seinen Leuten mit. Ich meine, einer so seiner engsten letzten Helfer in den Sprints war ja Lawrence Rex, der jetzt nächstes Jahr bei Sudal Quickstep fährt. Ja.
Aber ist es nicht vielleicht so rum, dass Lawrence Rex ihn nicht mitgenommen hat zu Quickstep? Vielleicht schon mal so rum gesehen?
Ja, ich glaube, haben beide ihre Daseinsberechtigungen so, ne? Aber ist natürlich jetzt grüne Trikot, ein paar Tour-Etappensiege. Der hat da, glaube ich, ein bisschen mehr Strahlkraft, aber mir erschließt dieser Move jetzt nicht so wirklich, ehrlich gesagt. Also würde ihn jetzt auch nicht so richtig in dieser neuen Lotto-Intermarché oder Intermarché-Lotto-Mannschaft sehen. Aber der Move hat mich jetzt schon so ein bisschen überrascht, ehrlich gesagt.
Ja, wo würde man den sehen, in welchem Team?
Na, Intermarché.
Eigentlich hat es ganz gut gepasst, muss ich sagen, ne? Bis dato. Ja. Also, das war ja echt, wie gesagt, diese Truppe da, Lawrence Rex.
Ich glaube, so Quickstep würde dem auch liegen.
Ja, aber ich meine, da haben wir schon Überangebot. Aber ich finde, in dem Team hat er auch gut gepasst. Wohl nie so richtig Stress, wenn er mal irgendwie nicht performt hat. Ist ein bisschen wie Emanuel Buchmann. So bei Gofides, weißt du so.
Das Gofides ist ja auch gut gewesen dann.
Da habe ich übrigens auch den nächsten Annäherungsversuch mal geplant.
Happy Place.
Dass wir endlich Emu Buchmann mal hier in Podcast kriegen.
Und es fehlt nur noch Jan Ulrich und Emanuel Buchmann, ne?
Ja.
Das sind so die.
Das ist wirklich, und Markus Burkhardt halt, ne?
Ja,
also auf Emu Buchmann habe ich auf jeden Fall.
Von meinem Radar verschwunden. Den einzigen Fahrer, den ich davon mal gerne, also den wir noch nicht hier hatten, den ich mal gerne wirklich im Besenwagen hätte, ist Maximilian Schachmann. Also viele Grüße nochmal. Hat mir schon zwei, dreimal dankend abgesagt. Aber den hätte ich hier mal gerne.
Ja, es gibt auf jeden Fall Leute, so Emanuel Buchmann ist halt jetzt auch definitiv nicht so der Typ für viel Interviews. Ihr wisst das selber. Aber auf den hätte ich auf jeden Fall am meisten Bock. Ich glaube auch, dass das eine Legende ist, der Typ.
Ja, kann ich bestätigen. Also,
ich hab Niki Merkel auf ihn angesetzt. So. Ich habe gesagt, beim nächsten Mal, wenn ihr zusammen fahrt, dann.
Ich wollte gerade sagen, das ist ja die Trainingsgruppe da unten, Trainingsgruppe Bodensee.
Ja.
Da ist er auf jeden Fall, also alleine schon da ist er eine Legende und natürlich auch im deutschen Radsport. Ne?
Ja, ja, jetzt, ich habe jetzt hier gerade mal dieses NSN-Team aufgemacht. So, ist schon eine wilde Truppe, ne? Also, da sind halt auch ein paar richtig gute drin. Gucken, wie es da weiter. Also, dieser Stevie Williams, der war ja auch, also, der auch mal brutalst performt. Dann Jake Stewart, ein paar echt heftige Ergebnisse eingefahren dieses Jahr. Das sind schon, ne? Louis Eske, Joe Blackmore, das sind so ein paar Briten, die echt.
Es ist jetzt per se kein schlechtes Team, ne?
Nee, aber es
hat jetzt so ein paar Issues jetzt gehabt in den letzten Monaten.
Ultra durchgewürfelt und diese Führungswechsel da jetzt oder Trägergesellschaftswechsel wird jetzt nicht sehr schnell zur Erholung da beitragen. Ich bin sehr gespannt.
Aber ja, Gmail wird sich schon was dabei gedacht haben. Ich denke mal, dass der Check auch ein bisschen größer eventuell ausfällt.
Und ja, das wird er sich auf jeden Fall dabei gedacht haben.
Das hilft manchmal auch bei der Entscheidungsfindung und ja.
Vielleicht hat er den Vertrag von Chris Froome übernommen.
Ja. So nämlich.
Also überleg mal, wie viel Geld da jetzt frei geworden ist, ne?
Da ist ein ganzes Team frei geworden.
Ist nicht Gmei, ist doch auch bei Carrera, oder?
Kann sein, ja.
Ja.
Gut, also wer ist nicht bei Alex Carrera?
Wer ist nicht bei Alex Carrera?
Also entweder sind sie bei euch oder bei Carrera.
Nee, das stimmt nicht. Also wir sind ja sehr exklusiv, muss ich ja sagen. Wir haben ja keine 30 Rollstuhlfahrer.
Euch gehört fast UAE. Haben wir gerade schon festgestellt.
Zumindest eine Grand Tour-Gruppe, Truppe von UAE könntet ihr fast komplett stellen.
Ja, ja, das stimmt schon, aber trotzdem sind wir ja eine vergleichsweise kleine Agentur. Also ich glaube, Carrera, der hat auf jeden Fall weit über 100 Fahrer, die er vertritt.
Ja, an die Masse.
Ja, aber der hat auf jeden Fall auch ein paar Top.
Aber das wird mir jetzt mal kurz ein
der hat ein paar gute Talente.
Der hat aber noch Assistenten und sowas, ne? Oder macht er alles alleine, die 100?
Nee, der hat schon ein Team, aber ich meine, ich sage, im wirklich bezahlten Radsport gibt es vielleicht 600 Plätze, kannst du so mehr oder weniger sagen. Ich würde mal behaupten, wenn du da 100 Fahrer vertrittst, kommst du mal hier und da in einen Interessenskonflikt, oder?
Eventuell.
Aber ja, gibt es auf jeden Fall noch zwei, drei andere Agenturen, die mit Sicherheit auch so um den Dreh sind in der Größe. Aber das wäre jetzt nicht so mein Ding, da könnte ich nicht so gut schlafen, glaube ich.
Wer ist denn noch so groß? Also SRG ist safe, aber wer ist noch so groß in die Richtung?
Ich kann's für die nächste Folge mal genau sagen, weil es gibt nämlich jetzt da ein bisschen gibt's Transparenz.
Oha.
Zumindest mal für die UCI, also du musst jetzt bei der UCI quasi anmelden, welche Fahrer du offiziell vertrittst, auch Vertragslaufzeiten und so, und die sind dann in so einer Datenbank, die man als Agent dann einsehen kann. Ja, das wurde jetzt erst dieses Jahr eingeführt, ja.
Weil ja immer wieder das Thema ist, dass der Teams so Verpflichtung bekannt geben mit, dieser Fahrer hat einen Vertrag unterschrieben, ohne zu sagen, wie lange. Also IF macht das ja ganz oft und auch andere Teams irgendwie.
Ach so, ja, ich weiß nicht, ob das jetzt wirklich so für die Öffentlichkeit gedacht ist.
Okay.
Aber irgendwie,
im Besenwagen also kann man es ja mal sagen.
Zum Beispiel findet ja auch schon eigentlich immer raus, wie lange die Verträge so laufen. Ist ja so.
Ja.
Also meistens bekannt. Und hier, genau, hier können wir es ja verraten.
Hier können wir es verraten. Ja, also wir können auf jeden Fall noch, ich kann noch nicht verraten, wo Gavin Tyson nächstes Jahr fahren wird. Sam Welsford haben wir jetzt schon gerüchteweise gehört.
Warum kannst du es noch nicht verraten? Fährt er auch bei Rockets.
Es sind da noch Plätze frei, glaube ich. Also bin gespannt.
Sam Wells,
Resterampe ist noch offen.
Ja, also außer du zwinkerst jetzt irgendwie bei Sam Welsford. Weil da habe ich
alle,
hab eigentlich irgendwo gehört, dass es Neos geht.
Die fahren alle nächstes Jahr bei den Rockets. Die schießen richtig mit
alle
Raketen
bei Rockets,
um sich. Ja. Alle nur noch Sprinter.
Also wenn Sam Welsford und Gavin Tyson da noch hingehen, dann wird es auf jeden Fall schnell.
Ja, dann fährst du einfach nur noch so 1.1 Rennen und sammelst richtig UCI-Punkte und dann World Tour.
In einem Jahr.
Nee, das geht nicht, also 3 Jahre. Wir können das ja hier bei Gelegenheit nochmal erklären, wie das funktioniert mit der Relegation.
Wir machen 2026 machen wir da mal eine Folge drüber.
Und ob Astana das nochmal schafft, ja, das ist eine gute Frage. Also
jetzt können die sich wieder 2 Jahre lang komplett ausruhen und einschlafen
was
und dann
ihr denn,
ein Jahr komplett rasieren.
Macht Astana dann nächstes Jahr weiter, wo sie eigentlich dieses Jahr aufgehört haben? Also nee, ich weiß gar nicht, wo sie am Ende rausgeguckt sind, das muss ich jetzt...
Die haben es jetzt einfach geschafft dieses Jahr, da wird jetzt erstmal Siesta gemacht, bin ich mir sicher.
Du, die haben doch dieses Jahr bestimmt einen Top-5-Platz in der Rangliste, oder?
Ja, vielleicht. Könnte, also.
Da bin ich mir relativ sicher.
Top 5 schon schwierig auf jeden Fall.
Doch, Mann, die sind Vierter dieses Jahr gewesen.
Geil.
Krass.
Also kommen dann über die 3 Jahre auf Platz 15, aber dieses Jahr mal richtig krass abgeräumt.
Auch krass, wie schlecht die einfach vorher dann waren.
Ja, also die können jetzt einfach wieder 2 Jahre gar nichts holen und dann wieder Vierter machen oder so.
Ja.
Ist halt auch spannend.
Ja, Spaß haben wir 2 Jahre Geld und dann wieder ein Jahr ein bisschen investieren.
Im Winter könnt ihr mal wieder einen Rap raushauen, wie vor 3 Jahren.
Das wäre eigentlich auch ein gutes Tippspiel, so Gesamtrangliste der Mannschaften nächstes Jahr. Also Platz 1 ja ziemlich eindeutig, aber dann wird es bestimmt spannend. Ja. Vor allem die Mannschaften haben ja für nächstes Jahr auch alle große Ziele, ne? Also
ja, das haben alle. Sie immer. Das wie alle deutschen Conti-Teams in 3 Jahren zur Tour. aber
ja, wir haben ja jetzt gleich jemanden, der uns über die Ziele von
Bora genommen. Der schon mal zur Tour gegangen ist. Überleitungskönig.
Ja.
Ja.
Nächste Runde, Trainingrunde, gesponsert von...
So, auch heute ist wieder mal Whoop Partner von uns im Besenwagen. Ihr kennt es mittlerweile schon seit ein paar Jahren hier mit dabei und man sieht es ja jetzt im Alltag auch immer öfter, also fällt mir zumindest auf. Und wir haben jetzt unter uns drei hier so eine kleine Challenge laufen, weil die Funktion, die mich auf jeden Fall am meisten catcht, ist der Health Span von Whoop, also das Alter, was dir Whoop ausrechnet. Und da habe ich ja gesagt, ich würde im nächsten Lebensjahr nicht altern. Und kaum habe ich das ausgesprochen, nächste Aktualisierung, habe ich zum ersten Mal geschafft, älter zu sein als mein tatsächliches Alter. Aber, um es jetzt noch zu Ende zu bringen, danach habe ich jetzt zum ersten Mal meinen Alterungsprozess in die verjüngende Richtung bekommen. Vorher war ich immer so ziemlich genau bei 1 oder halt mal auch schlechter. Und jetzt bin ich schon bei 0,7. Jetzt muss ich natürlich noch ein bisschen weiter in Richtung Jugend streben. Und was soll ich sagen? Zone 2 Training machen nicht nur World Tour Profis, sondern bald auch wieder Andi Stauf.
aber ganz ehrlich, so Dezember ist auch irgendwie kein Monat, um jünger zu werden. Es ist irgendwie alles anstrengender. Es ist kälter, dunkler. Mir geht's, also ich werde auch auf jeden Fall jetzt gerade wieder schneller älter, aber ich bin auch nur auf der 0,Schiene.
Ja, ich bin jetzt im Land des Vitamin-Ds angekommen und ihr könnt euch darauf freuen, dass ich bald noch jünger bin.
Unser Küken bist du hier, Paul.
Absolut.
Vielleicht wachsen dir dann auch wieder die Haare zurück.
Wenn ich die Anfrage da annehme, bestimmt. Die Kooperationsanfrage.
Ja, wir haben uns nämlich gerade über den Wetteinsatz, den wir hier für die Challenge laufen haben, unterhalten. Und einer davon war, dass Paul sich wieder Haare implantieren lässt, aber dazu dann demnächst mehr.
Wir müssen das noch ein bisschen genauer herausfinden. Bis dahin ist ja noch ein bisschen Zeit. Und ihr könnt euch auf jeden Fall gut mitmotivieren lassen, wenn ihr das nicht eh schon tut, von Whoop, der App, dem Healthspan und den verschiedenen vielen anderen Funktionen, die positiv für euren Lebenswandel und eure Gesundheit sind. Und wenn ihr das Ganze mal ausprobieren wollt, beziehungsweise jetzt interessiert geworden seid, dann geht auf join.whoop.com/Besenwagen. Langer Link, also einfach Shownotes draufklicken und dann habt ihr die Möglichkeit, das A, einen Monat kostenlos zu testen und B, wenn ihr dann eine der verschiedenen Mitgliedschaften ausprobieren wollt, das Ganze mit uns noch ein bisschen günstiger zu bekommen. join.woop.com/Besenwagen. As I already said in the intro and as quite obviously by this pullover or hoodie. We got someone from Red Bull Bora on the pod tonight. And I already introduced and maybe, Zach doesn't know, but we kind of have a team chef trilogy now because we had Christian Niermann 2 weeks ago, last week Jana Seel from UAE, and now Zach Dempster, who is the new, you can correct me at once, head of sports or something at Red Bull Bora. And we are super curious to know how you got there. And we got also somebody here on the podcast who knows you pretty good for a while, because you two raced some years ago on a smaller team, which is now the team you are working on, and you are in a position where you can say what the riders have to do next year. So first of all, welcome Zach Dempster.
Thanks for having me. That's actually chief of sports. I can't have a cool title without using it, you know.
Chief of sports.
Yeah, it's a very German title, but
but do you also have like a, do you have now also a card where it says Zach Dempster, chief of sport?
I do, yeah. They actually someone came up to me in the office the other day in Niedendorf, and just handed me a thick envelope of business cards. So got my first business card, which is pretty cool.
People nice. Still using them.
Well, apparently so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, just for some context, of course, I put some numbers down here, and just to give the listener who doesn't know you some context around, you are 37 years old, when I'm not wrong.
38, which, actually.
38. 38, all right. And you raced at the first team I put down here was Rafa Condor for 2010 and 2011, which I found was a cool team, so I wrote it down here. You are from Australia, and before you raced in Australia on Conti teams, then went to Europe, as I imagine, 2010, and then you changed in 2012 to NetApp Endura, which became Bora Argon 18, where also Paul rode. And in 2017 to 2019, you raced for Israel Startup Nation, it was back then. I read also on Wikipedia that you did study sports science besides your career, and afterwards you came into a position of a director sportif, which you did first at Israel and then at Ineos, and now we are at Bora, and this should be the short version of all. Was I wrong at some point?
You made a few mistakes, but that's okay. I'm comfortable with my profile.
Zach, I'm just on your Poseidon Stats side, and I just realized that we actually been teammates for 5 years. I thought it was just four, but it was actually five.
Yeah, that's the Enduro time was a happy year with Alex back then. Paul and I raced on an Enduro racing team together in 2011.
12,
yeah. Mm. And that was a cool time. It was like a few ex-pros like Paul. I hadn't been pro yet. And we were just in a transit van cruising around Europe, smashing it and doing 6 hours behind the scooter every Wednesday in Girona. So true, yeah. I think if I look back, like that was probably, yeah, in terms of how dialed it was, you know, that was just pure racing.
That was probably the best continental team in the world back then, right? I mean, your most successful rider. He was, fast for a reason. But the older team was pretty strong. I remember that you actually had the level of a pro Conti team for sure.
But I have to say, like the when I came from Murom in the end of 10 to 11, and 11 and 12 were actually like the best years in like my career regarding like the team structure. Everything was quite dialed in and was actually quite nice. I have to say, it was some good times. So.
Yeah, I think when I think back to my career too, is like when you now in this day and age of big sponsors and big structures and all that stuff, like a lot of these solutions to make people or bike riders better, they're not expensive or complicated. Like if you think about the key person in that, I don't know about for you, Vossi, but for me it was Alex Sansvega, like 8 o'clock at the train station, and then off you went behind him on the motorbike for you didn't really know how long. he would just tell you what training you had to do, and that was Wednesdays, you know. Get back in at 5 o'clock when the sun was coming down, and it's not complicated, you know. So I think a lot of that, I guess what I see now, my learnings from that time come a lot into play in my professional life.
I think the episode today will be a lot about getting to know who you are, also for the German fans and listeners. Before we jump into the detail of the season, then okay.
I told you that's not funny at all.
I fucked up this joke completely. Like, your media department told us it's totally impossible to talk about the season of where where will the riders ride, where will Remco ride, and which Grand Tour will Lipovitz do. So I would say normally I forgot it. I wanted to introduce you with the with the result of going. Now we are going into in a deep dive of the season of Remco.
We're just going to focus on Tour Down Under and Deutschland Tour.
Exactly. actually, let's get to know you, where you come from, and how you could jump in this position. And the first question would be, like, you are from Australia. How did you come to cycling there?
I mean, like, cycling in Australia is a bit of a secondary or third sport from where I live. So I'm from central Victoria, I was born in a place called Castlemaine. But if you look like where the velodromes in my area, you know, there's a town 30 k's away. They had a velodrome and a club, another town 40 k's away, same thing. So even now, you know, it's maybe not as much as it was in the when I was coming through, but there's still that really grassroots level of cycling there. So my dad was he did triathlon apart from being a boner in a pig factory. Mm-hmm. And he did two Hawaii Ironmans when I was like 11 and 12. So I got a trip to Hawaii and a week off school. And I think that really inspired me to basically take my bike seriously. So I was doing BMX at the time, and then I started to take road cycling. Like, I felt really inspired by endurance sport at that time. So that's how I got into it and went through track cycling initially. So that's how it all came to be.
And then there are also, at which age did you start to race?
Yeah, it would have been, I was racing BMX, I guess, from when I was like 10, along with playing other sports and dominating karate. But then I really started to take it seriously kind of when I was 15 type thing. I like gave up playing football and really like focused on making junior worlds and things like that. So yeah, between let's say 15 and 18, that was a really pivotal time in Australia before I got the chance to come over to Europe in 2007, actually, with the national team to race over here. So,
did you have any idols? Have you had some Australian riders which were cool at that time?
Yeah, I think everyone loves Stewie. Like, Stewie was really cool, you know. He was the guy, if I think back to, you know, the Crédit Agricole days, like, we used to get like the highlights at 6 o'clock, half an hour highlights of the tour, and me rushing back to watch that. You know, that was a pretty, like, he was an important figure, you know. And then came this whole generation through of sprinters with obviously Robbie and, you know, Alan Davis even. These guys were all like up there. Competitive Baden Cook, who's from Victoria as well, just down the road. So there was always like this kind of culture of guys over there in Europe, you know.
It's Stuart O'Grady, you mean?
Yeah, Stuart. There's only one Stuart.
I heard really good stories of him. So this is one we should have here.
And they're all true.
They're all true. But I think they're meant to be, to stay unofficial.
Yeah, maybe. Some people already like told us some stories here too.
Yeah, but did you went to Belgium then, like everyone else did? Or?
Yeah.
To France.
Oh, so I did 2007, 2008 with the national team, which was like that pretty epic kit. Maybe you can get a photo up with a kangaroo and it's like purple and orange, southaustralia.com.
I remember that one, yeah.
And then basically that program, like I just couldn't make the front group. I mean, I'm sure Staff, who knows what I'm talking about. If you're 80 kilos in Italy, then it's pretty hard to win amateur races there. So I made a decision to... I got picked up by a Bulgarian Conti team in 2009. And off I went to Belgium and lived initially with the sport director and then with a Belgian family that took me in. So I did 209 in Belgium before then I went to Rafa in 2010 and 11, where I lived in Bristol. So I did my time in Belgium 1 year.
I remember also that family. Is it true that they came visiting you always when we did the races in Belgium
I was really lucky. They kind of saved me, to be honest. Like, they came and visited me at the sport director's house, and they offered me the chance to go and live with them. And they've always I'm still really close to them now. And they were really important in my career. Like, without them, I think I would have been on the plane back from Brussels to Melbourne pretty quick.
Yeah, there are similar stories from different riders all over the world that they have like this second family in Belgium, you know, and people that supported them when they were younger, and they're still around sometimes at the races.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Even like if you think of like Alan Piper, like that's a story if you read his book and see what he went through, you know, and what the Plankarts did for him, taking him in. It's incredible, the stories and the connections that you make just through, again, sport in a way. You know, that's the thing that ties it all together. But, yeah, I guess for Australians it's a more common theme just given our geographical location.
All right, and then did you move to Great Britain?
Yeah, then I went to Bristol. I kind of given up on the dream of being a pro the first year with Rafa. I thought I'll go to the UK, and I knew Tom Southam, who's a sport director on EF. So he kind of linked me in with John Herity, and at the time there was some Australians on that team, and I went to Bristol, and we did like a little bit like an enduro calendar, I would say, Paul. Like, we did Bretagne and some races like this, Normandy, and I lived basically that year like a uni student because I figured it was like the last dance. And then the following year I took it a bit more serious because I'd been getting second a lot, and then that kind of led to some more bike racing results, actually, not surprisingly. And then I did a stage for HTC in the year it was folding, so I got offered the stage during the tour, and I did that, and then I went to Enduro, and then I was with Fosse for 5 years.
Yeah, happy times.
did you guys make the move to Bora together in the same year, or
no? Probably team. So from Enduro I went into NetApp Enduro, and from NetApp Enduro it became Bora. There was always the same team. Also, like, it merged. So Enduro and NetApp merged, and then out of NetApp it became what it is now. So it was always the same team after we left basically Enduro, the British team. We went to Ralph, and that's
we had Bora on the sleeve, right, when we did the tour.
Yeah. Yeah, we had Bora on the sleeve in our first year at the tour, I think 2014, So it was always the same kind of structure, It's just funny, like, because when I see now who is sports director with the team and who was a sports director back in the day with us, it's interesting. And, I mean, it was, again, it was a good time, but, like, messaged you, was happy to see you getting this position, but also seeing you going through the ranks with like Israel and then Ineos, and then now where you are, just reminding me of like the years we had at like the tour over Welter, where you did certain programs already, or you made your own plans regarding nutrition and warm ups, and you tried out a few things, and kind of back then you could always see that you probably will step into that direction in the future, like controlling things and trying to work in a bigger picture.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that kind of struck me when I had to make this decision, you know, because I actually, like, I love sport directing. Like, it is a super cool job. But I felt myself kind of gravitating more to the big picture, right? And that was a big part of my decision. So, I mean, in the end, I'm really grateful to have the chance to try this new role. But the thing I've discovered in these 60 days or so that I've been here, is that like there's a bunch of stuff that I'm learning. And I think that for me is the, I guess what I crave. Like for me, it needs to be something fresh and new and I need to learn it. And there's a bunch of stuff in this role that's way different to what I was doing the last 6 years.
Mm. Yeah. But how did you, so like the, your last year was 19, right? As a pro.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was on, yeah. So I did, I mean, how did I end up going to the role, you mean, or?
Yeah, yeah. So like the decision from like stopping as a rider in 2019 and then becoming a sports director, what like what was the decision behind that or the reason?
At the end of, so I did the Giro 2018, the one that threw me one. And I think there I kind of accepted that I wasn't very good. And
took some time for you to realize.
Yeah, I'm stubborn. I'm stubborn like that. And then
I know, but wait, you've been a good bike rider. It's not like you were not good.
Yeah, I was average at best, Bossy. Come on. So I think after that Giro, I was like, I'd signed a new contract for the next year. And the Australian Federation approached me to see if I'd be interested to do something kind of with their development project. It wasn't like an offer or anything. It was just to see if I was interested. And I knocked it back because I wanted to race still. And I did that next year. I just did a program that totally suited me, to be honest. So I did like 1.1s and all these kind of, dirtbag races in Belgium that no one wants to do. But it was what I was good at because I could get my front wheel ahead of other people. And that year I really enjoyed it. It was like pure racing for me. And it felt like I was almost like a kid again, you know. And I think it was one of my better years, to be honest. And in the summer, Chell, the manager of Israel Cycling Academy at the time, said to me, hey, we're thinking about, you know, offering you a 6 months riding, 6 months, or then going into a DS role. And then in the end, the merger came about with Katusha. And I was kind of done with it then. Like in my head, I figured that, well, I was first of all proud and content with my career, to be honest, even though I say that I was average, that's also okay for me. But I was like craving, okay, well, what's next? Because hopefully I've still got a few years of my life left. And I really felt passionate about, you know, staying in sport, doing something. And in the end, this role that came through with Israel was perfect for me because I got to see so many different levels of the team, you know. So, yeah, to be honest, nobody really knew that I was going to retire. And then I was in UCI at the time doing my level 4 or level 3 coaching while I was still racing. Like I won Wiedendahl while I was like part studying actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I just basically got planned to Paris Tours. My girlfriend, who's now my wife, flew in and that was my last bike race there.
Okay. And then you just like said, all right, I want to work as a sports director with Israel.
Yeah. So my original remit was like to set up the Conti project for the first year. So I think like more or less 10 days after Paris Tours, I flew out to Israel and started meeting people because we had like half the team there. Then and set up that project. I think Bossy, that's where we met each other in Poland, in those Polish races, the dirt races.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
2020, when you were doing some DSing too. And then that kind of escalated quite quickly. So then I think in the first year I was more focused on the Conti, but then I did the Vuelta. The following year I did the Tour and the Vuelta. And then the following year during the Tour de France, Sylvain made me head sport director during that tour. And then at the tour presentation I quit and I went to Ineos. And then I spent like the same kind of time working my way through Ineos to a point where the last couple of years I led both the Giro and the Tour.
Where did you, like when you went to Ineos, on which position did you start? Like just as a normal sports director or?
Yeah, I kind of made the decision, like it was almost a step. Well, I was head sport director on Israel then, but I felt like I needed to make a change to really understand how Grand Tour projects were built. And I think Ineos was the team that was doing that well in recent history. So it wasn't an easy decision, to be honest, because at that time I was also doing like the men's what, the national sport director for the pros. So when Michael Matthews was third, I was the sport director there, and I had to give that up. But I think it was, you know, looking back in hindsight, I think it was a really good decision because, yeah, I was able to be exposed to some really great people in INEOS. Not to say in Israel there's really good people as well, but in INEOS I felt like it really gave me the chance to evolve as a professional, and I'm really grateful to them for that.
What do you think are your talents? What makes you good in this position?
I'm very, very direct. Like, I think there's not... Fossey knows that.
I remember, like, always when, like, we went to, like, dinner with, like, other Australians, it's like, you always told me afterwards, you're too German or you're too direct, but you were actually, like, you're so German with that as well. You're, like, compared to... I mean, Aussies are also direct, but you're different. You're, like, really, like, German direct. Directness. yeah. It's true. You're actually really direct, yeah.
I think I don't know. I don't know what makes me... I think I'm direct. I think I'm pretty structured as well. I think I've got a decent level of empathy. Yeah. Never... really thought much about. I don't even know if I'm good, really. I'm just trying to be me.
Yeah, it goes, you know, pretty well so far from the outside. So,
but from
the,
like,
word direct also to, like, comes from sports director. You know, that's.
Before we jump what you're doing now, it will be interesting for me, like, to know, like, I mean, in Israel, of course, is a good team. Blah blah blah, but. At INEOS, it's more structured from the outside as well, I will say. And how was the move from, like, being, like, a normal sports director to, like, leading the Tour and the Giro? It's much more, I mean, the responsibility must be so much bigger.
Yeah, I feel like, so my first year on INEOS, actually, I did, like, a little bit. Well, I did all, like, kind of the alternative program. So Rod Ellingworth, who was still there at the time, and they gave me, like, a lot of the projects that things like Mercier and Hain and Swiss, and they gave me, basically, I led all the races I did almost, you know. So that gave me a good chance to develop my leadership skills, to be honest. So rather than going to, let's say, play the second sport director role in a Grand Tour, and that helped me to, like, fast track, I would say. At the same time, I was exposed to, let's say, even like Kanisi leading in UA, I was exposed to other sport directors who were, you know, super diligent and proactive, and exposed me to another, I guess, like, how can I say it? I felt really at home in that group of how driven the sport directors were in INEOS. But at the same time, my program, it just allowed me to develop, I guess, all those skills that you need to lead a Grand Tour project. So then they gave me the Giro the following year, and that was kind of planned to be the Grand Tour I would lead. But then obviously in the second year, 2 week, or not even, like, a week out from the Tour de France, Steve wasn't able to lead the Tour. So then I basically got given the Tour de France to lead it like a sport director a week out last year. So that was an experience. And then obviously there was a whole Netflix thing with Tom the year before, and then we still had Netflix there, and they'd done all this filming. So that was an experience, let's put it that way, but it was really cool and I really enjoyed it. So yeah, it was kind of like a fast track through a few situations that unfolded.
What do you think is your biggest success so far as a sports director or as a leader of the team? Or is it a personal success, maybe?
I mean, there's probably two I'd pick out. I think, Tymon winning from the GC group in the Tour this year was really special. Like, Tymon's a really good kid, and, I think he's been quite open with his, you know, the battles with the pressure and all those types of things. And in the end, like, just trying to remind him throughout that Tour de France that, you know, it's just a bike race, man. was, I think, you know, that playing out there to Laplan was really a super beautiful moment in the car, to be frank. And then the other one I'd probably pick out as well, and there's so many, honestly, would be Johnny Navarez in the Giro last year. Like, not many guys beat Pog, but that plan that we kind of hatched with him to, because he was kind of a little bit on the outer in Ineos, and together with Ollie Cookson, we were like, no, we need him in the Giro. It's a 4-minute climb. He can do 8 watts a kilo. Like, he can't drop him, you know, and then he'll suck the stickers off his helmet in the sprint, we felt. And he did, you know. So I would say, in terms of, like, the Johnny one was a long-term hatch plan that we felt would set up the Giro to be a really happy place, and it was. And then the one with Timon was just a bit more personal and by accident almost, and it wasn't easy, and it was, you know, he won that stage anyway beforehand, and that was just him, yeah, letting it go and doing what he does. So those are two really different examples, but for me those are two really nice ones from the time at Ineos.
Yeah, also that, because after the win, the second stage of Timon Arensman at the Tour, you, I think I saw an interview with you straight away after the finish line where they came to you, and they look, could really see, like, I mean, I think when you know someone, then you kind of see the emotions, but I could see the emotions within you. Like, when you spoke about that win, it was actually quite nice to see. And then I thought, like, how stressful are these races, and actually for you leading a team at the race? So it's like, I mean, in the football, we know it's like, if the team is not performing, it's the coach, you know, coach is the first one who has to go. In cycling, usually the first one to go is the rider, not the people in the team, you know, like giving the structure and so on. So how much pressure do you actually feel?
That also changed a little bit, right, Paul?
Yeah, it changed, but it still feels like riders kind of are on the wrong side, you know, of it.
Yeah. I feel like for me, like, at the end of the day, if you create the right environment, and the way I can kind of conceptualize it is like, you have, like, you're all a part of making the plan, right? And it's not like the plan is not, it's not me, it's not Timon, it's not whoever it might be, it's not the coach only. And if you can get that kind of group ownership and not be afraid of, there's this term called failing your way to success. Like, if you're not afraid of that, then, and you're willing to have the balls to try, then I feel like you can create a lot more momentum as a group, you know. So I think what people are looking for in something like a high pressure environment like that is support. And I think when you share that ownership, you can do great things.
At some point at NetApp Endura, or just before, you met Ralf Denk for the first time. And now he got you back in the team on another position. So there's like a
switch of, I also wrote it down.
Switch of levels. Yeah.
It's like 10 years, right? The first time you joined his team, and now you're coming back after, as you left the team 2016. Now you're coming back 10 years later. How was it also in between? Yeah, did you stay in touch, or was it just recently that you connected again? How did that go?
I mean, I always said hi. Like, I remember I was out training for the Qatar Worlds, and Ralf called me in September, and I kind of made the call myself. Like, I wasn't in a good place, to be honest, the last kind of 18 months of my time at Bora. And it's not anything really on the team, for sure. Every team can improve things, and that's just part of racing to an extent. But Ralf and I kind of had a conversation on the side of the road that I'm not going to be able to offer you a contract. And I said, look, I've already actually signed with Israel. I'm really appreciated. Because in the end, like, I would never have done the tour if it wasn't for Ralf Denk and that camper on NetApp. And, like, it was a pretty efficient setup, I'm sure. Vossi can tell you. So I owe a lot to that team, to this team. In the end, we left on really good terms. I always said hello. And then I think it was they sent me a jersey when they did, like, the 10-year anniversary of them doing the first tour. I got it as well. And I'd send him an email. Was really the first kind of contact we had, and say, hey, thanks, that was a really nice touch. And then, yeah, from there we started some conversations when he wanted to look around for this position. So, yeah. in general, it was really, we didn't have a lot of contact all the time, that's for sure.
But do you know why he contacted you for this position? I mean, like, it's not like you're just a sports director. You have much more control, you have much more to say, and the things you do have, like, I guess, a kind of big impact on, like, how the team's developing in next years. So why do you think he contacted you? I mean, of course, you've been a rider there for a long time, but also in the years we've been there as a rider, and we shared, I don't know, like, probably more than 50% of the time also the room. So there was a lot of discussion between us, like, of what we could improve in the team back then. And there was also a lot of friction sometimes in the team with, like, sports directors and so on. I think which was positive in the end also. Not all the time, but sometimes. And I was just wondering, like, why he went to you, because you're still young. Of course, you've been head of sports director, like, for Ineos, but you haven't been in that role before. And at the moment, there are, like, a really big shift in the team. Like, you know, like, they have now big riders in the team. They just finished third at the Tour, so there's a lot of pressure. And then it's just, I think you're the right person, but, like, I was surprised that he actually contacted you. Yeah.
I think, like, in the end, like, what I've come to realize is that, like, when you're a bike rider, you're kind of just in your world, and like, I think about the conversations you and I had of solving the world's problems, you know, Bossy, and it's like, there's so much else going on, you know, that you kind of discover after. But at the same time, I mean, he's told me why, like, I think he, like, did his homework and asked around how I was. And then in the end, it's a bit of a risk. I mean, we're only 60 days in and no one's pinned a number on yet. But I think one of the key strategic priorities of Red Bull is, like, talent development also for the staff. So even the thing that I see now when I've come into the team is, like, you know, a bunch of young people that are actually killing it. Like, the team's going in the right direction. And I think, hopefully I'm able to play a key part in that, like so many others will.
Yeah, that's actually a good point there, because from my point of view, not a lot of teams, they help their staff, you know, getting more educated on certain topics, which is, when you compare it to different companies or enterprises, that, you know, every staff or every employee gets somehow the chance to develop. And in cycling teams, it used to be, okay, you've been a rider, now you become a sports director, and then and that's it, you know. And that was, I also wanted to ask you the question, if you did any, you know, seminars or whatever on skills like leadership or stuff like that, put you effort into it yourself, you know, like reading books or, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think Ineos can be, they're really great for that, to be honest. So there's always this, I think it's called the Sports Leadership Summit. It's in London every year. And I went a couple of times that you know, Ineos organized that it was optional. So I think Ian Stannard and I went with Robbie Anderson, who was the head of people or culture at the time. And I got a whole heap out of that, just those 2 days, you know. As an example, one of the keynote speakers there was the chief of surgery for the NHS in the UK, so like the hospital system, and she spoke about debriefing and how they do that in surgery. And it really, like, kind of opened up my mind to, you know, are we doing this in a structured way, the chat on the bus after the race? And that kind of created this system that we put in place that I felt like, not always, but I felt like that got us improving every day a little bit more, you know, even in the Tour de France this year. So I was exposed to that thanks to Ineos and the systems that are in place there, which are a bit more business-like actually. And I think if now, the position that I'm in now and where this team needs to go, like, the focus does need to be on the people, you know, and the talent within. And given, you know, the Red Bull environment and how much expertise is out there, like, it's a huge advantage for us, and we'd be silly not to structure how we do that in the right way to focus on improving not only the bike riders, but also the people.
Maybe you can, I mean, a lot of our listeners probably know what a sports director does, but maybe not everyone. Maybe you can just like describe a little bit what you did until now and then what's changing now in the chief of sports position.
Yeah, so I guess the best way to describe a sport director for me is he's like a project manager for the race. So, you know, like the lead sports director for me should know everything. He's not responsible for totally everything, but he definitely should know that if there's a long transfer and how to coach the guys or the staff through that, or if he should be sending reminders. So for me, he holds the key to the race in his hands or their or her hands, to be totally frank. So I think it's real project management. You know, how can we get this vision of how it will play out in the Tour de France or in Tirreno or whatever it is, and make it a reality. So you know, normally you have three sport directors on the most important races, and they all contribute in their own way. One will manage like the logistics of managing the staff and all those things. One could be more driving the car, making sure the radios are all, every detail is taken care of. But at the end, I guess the best teams are where I've felt the most, let's say, engaged and everything, is where you all have everything so dialed that you've got time to talk about the race, which I think that's the biggest mistake of most sport directors, is not having the time to talk to the guy, to connect with him, to coach him on what they're likely to go through. So I guess my philosophy on that was where I get that structured part of my personality, is like taking care of that stuff to get to the coaching, you know. So that's, I guess that's how I could best describe being a sport director. And then what I'll do now, like it's all totally new for me a little bit. So, you know, we've got Ollie Cookson, who's the head of racing. He's the head sport director per se. So he's managing more that sport director group at the moment. Then obviously within that, you'll have your leads for the Tour de France, your leads for the Giro or the Wind project, which we'll create now. Then you've got John Wakefield, who's the director of coaching, sport science and technical development. So he's kind of in the department around coaching and aero and all that stuff. Then you have Jan Niklas Drost. Bossy was a young doctor when we came. Like
he's still there.
He went off and he was in Leipzig in football, and now he's only just recently come back. But he is brilliant. So yeah, he's like all over like health and performance and all this stuff. So I'm really grateful to have him.
He was really into like all this like new tech shit already back in the day, like trying out like these weird things with like energy supply and all this stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, but on top of that, like, he's a really, really, I don't know, personable guy. So, like, I've had some experiences with him where he's, like, you know, a guy's crashed in China. He's the first one there at the hospital managing everything. So, he's right there with that leadership team. And then also there's Tim Mewson, who's he was the head scout, but now he's going to become the director of development, which John Wakefield did before. And so basically my role now is more in that group, managing the big picture, let's say. So for sure, I'm still involved in some face-to-face conversations with riders, but I would say, yeah, let's say 80% of my time is more invested in everything, big picture stuff, more or less.
Yeah, but that's super interesting. Yeah, you step into this team and I imagine... Yeah, you kind of have fun in planning things like that, planning races or planning the season. And to be honest, I think they put you in the position that you shall plan Grand Tour victories now, which maybe wasn't the case before so much. So how do you approach that? Also, that pressure. Because it's there, kind of, I think.
Yeah. Nah, I'm not so. I don't feel personally like I want to be up behind a fucking good plan. That's what I want to get at, you know? Yeah. And I feel like if I've got some sort of agenda that I don't want it to be a good plan for some reason, then it's not like I wouldn't feel right, you know? So in terms of the pressure behind that, I don't have a whole heap of that, if I'm frank. Like, I think bold decisions lead to great moments. And, you know, one of the key things in my role now is being decisive, for sure, listening and all those things. But people need you to be decisive. And what's the essence of that is, yeah, as I say, making a fucking good plan. So I think as a group, we've got the expertise to do that. If it'll work or not, you know, who knows? But let's give it the time to build it in a way that people feel that it's theirs and we can own it as a group. And yeah, for sure, if we make mistakes along the way, then we'll be upfront about that and learn them. But in terms of the pressure of delivering, you know, the results or the outcome, which is, it's business, it's sport, for sure I want to do that. So I don't feel so much the pressure of it.
To which extent do you take rider's point of view into consideration for your plans?
For something so difficult, you need to feel a strong connection to what you're doing, you know? But they also need to understand they fit into the big picture of the team. You know, there are 30 guys plus all the rookies. So definitely we listen. And then what I hope that they feel from me is that we do listen. And if the plan is different, then we can articulate why and why it fits into what they need to contribute to the team or why it's better for them at this stage of their career. So again, it just comes back to that, you know, this formulation of the plan together, listening to the riders is an absolutely integral part of that process.
Yeah, makes sense. You know, you can't just send them to races and expect them to, you know, burn for it if it's not there. If they don't believe it should be their goal, right?
I'm not one to ever avoid a tough conversation either. You know, if I feel like they're not aligned, because in the end, like, not every team's the right place, you know, same for me in 2016. So there's always like conversations to be had of like, right, well, you know, we're not aligned here, but let's have the conversation so that we can go forward and do what we do. Not necessarily leaving the team, but at least having the same plan.
So maybe you can just, you know, give us an example of a typical decision you have to make from the... So I guess all those departments you mentioned, they report to you and then they make a suggestion for, let's say, aerodynamics, we will use this setup for special kind of races, and you say, okay, let's do it, or do they make the decision, those decisions on your own, and you just, you know, get an overview if everything is working, and or are you in the end taking those decisions?
Yeah, like I'm not at the bus going around checking tire pressures, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of it is on, yeah, like the direction of projects per se. So at the moment, obviously the big one, which we're still in process for, so is the race program strategy, you know, so we're quite far along. You know, obviously you need to wait for the park coolers, and at the moment it's, you know, the asking the right questions, you know, do we do, does it make sense to do Indurain before Pays Vasco? What program should we go for Geordie this year to maximize his win potential? Things like that are the discussions I kind of get involved in. And then on top of that, there might be things to do with partners on how we prioritize which innovation projects we want to push partners on. So obviously we've got, you know, Dan Bigham on the team who's the expert, you know, but maybe asking the right questions can help him. So in the end, I feel like this role is really about being there for the people that are the experts on the thing and helping them also find their way into the big picture of hopefully winning more bike races.
So it's more people management, actually.
Yeah, I would say so. Like, the thing that's been strange for me. Like, as a lead sport director for a grand tour, you're often involved on really structural stuff, like how am I going to present, you know, the grand tour, the strategy for the Giro, as an example, diving into details and all this stuff. Whereas at the moment, what I find is I spend most of the day kind of in back-to-back meetings, and then the structural stuff I do might be to do with like a standard operating procedures, like even just asking the question to the group, hey, do we need to update anything here, or are we missing anything? Because I've seen a few areas where it's, from a business sense, maybe we can tighten some things up, you know? So, and people want to, at the end, if you're in a team where people want to be good or they want to do best practice, let's work on a way to articulate that. Okay, that's our way, off we go, you know? And the big opportunity, I think, now in that area is that we've got so many people coming from so many different teams that it's actually not even an option that, you know, obviously I'm coming from Ineos, but we've got Klaas coming from Quickstep, Tony coming from Lotto, Sven coming from a national team thing. We've got coaches from Visma previously. Like, I think we're at a place where we could actually just create our way, you know? And that's something really powerful for the group that we should and we will own, I hope.
Sounds exciting, for sure.
Let's talk about goals. There's
been so many changes also in the management, right? Somehow it for sure will be a new team next year. I mean, there's almost there's a lot of old structure is gone, and you need to become a team again, and for sure that will show in a different way of maybe racing, approaching things. Yeah,
definitely. But I think there's still a lot of good to celebrate. You know, that's the thing that I tried to get across when I got here, was like, you know, what was good? You know, if you think about Lippo, who would have thought Lippo would have been third in the Tour de France? Like, holy fuck, that guy has progressed, you know, and thinking even to World Tour races this year, for him, like, it's a super exciting time to go to Romandie's or wherever it is. Like, we've got the talent and the expertise, so this is a pretty cool time at the moment.
Did you now also move to Bavaria or to the south of Germany?
No.
You can see at his doors, he's still in Spain.
Okay.
yeah. So I'm in, I live 60 km north of Girona, a place called Olot now, and then we're actually moving. We're in the process of moving to Andorra now, which would be will be nice. I'm going to work on my skiing, which I've never done because there's three mountains in Australia with snow. So it wasn't my forte.
Yeah. Any goals you set yourself for the season? I actually don't expect concrete goals now.
We're in that process. We head to Mallorca on Saturday, and we're going to talk about that with the rider group there. I think, you know, they all have to fit into that, because in the end it's a program strategy, you know. For me personally, I feel I want to get to this time next year and see that the team's won more, that people feel like they have contributed to that. So definitely, like, the outcome's important, but also the feeling of people and the how content they are with what they're able to contribute. That's super important to me. So although it's hard to quantify, I feel like I'll see it and hear it throughout the year if we are making that happen.
So now this process starts. Everybody wants to know, like, your marketing department told us not to ask about. Just curious, but you have so many good Grand Tour riders now. It's like, it's incredible how many. If you think about it, yeah. Of course, you have the big ones, Lippo, Primoz, Remco. But you have Jai, you have Pellizzari, you have even Vlasov, and I still think I have Dani Martinez. Now, in the camp, in the Mallorca camp, you start to think about where to send whom.
Yeah, I mean, these discussions are ongoing. obviously we got the Giro, well, the final Giro parkour 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still some conversations to be had, and this has been, you know, a key part of the DS and coach group's work now, has been having those conversations, deciding who, assessing where it suits which rider best. So yeah, I think in Mallorca these are the times to have kind of the final chats to really decide that. Generally speaking though, it's easy to worry about. There's more guys not in our jersey that we should worry about, you know? So I think realistically nowadays, besides Pogan and Jonas, like, you need to go with dual leader strategy to most of the grand tours. So we're in a privileged position, but you also have to get them to their best level on the start line before you can even think about any tough decisions that need to be made. So I guess that really isn't a focus of mine at the moment, how to balance it. You know, we'll have those tough conversations if needed, but at the same time, there's plenty of bike races to go around.
Sure.
Yeah. Just send us a mail when you know it. Yeah, I'm pretty happy so far. Which questions do my friends have left here?
I wrote down, is it Project Wins or is it Project Wings?
Well, I don't know. This could be a marketing question, actually. No, I think I can talk about this now. So, like, for us, one of the things is, you know, building that winning mindset and winning momentum towards next year. So, you know, there's often this, it's often called the B program, where I spent plenty of my career, where you're kind of doing races like Arctic Race, right? Stuff. Yeah. And I think UAE's provided a really good example, and Quickstep have for years and years, of just about how you can, you know, put importance on every bike race. Like, it just doesn't make sense from a budget perspective to not take everyone seriously. Like, we're a racing team, you know? So rather than call it the alternative program, which sometimes comes across, I think for next year, we haven't actually signed it off yet, but I think we'll call it the win project. So win, which is really about, you know, providing, well, there's like this concept, right, in sport that, you know, to develop at the fastest level or the fastest way possible, you spend some time, let's say, playing or racing at your level. You spend a little bit of time racing above to really push you, but you also spend time sometimes racing below. So like in football before a World Cup, I remember there was a guy called Gus Hiddink, who was coaching the Socceroos back to the World Cup. And like right before the World Cup, where they were quite successful, he had him play a bunch of club teams and absolutely smash them, you know? So I think even for your Remcos or your Lippos, you know, when we build that program, that's a consideration for me. You know, like, is it only Dauphiné Tour always, or do we consider a Slovenia? Do we throw them into some races, like if there would be a cobble stage, like a Dinan? So I think there's a really cool project there for us, which is about building momentum, learning how to win, relearning for some guys. Like, you often forget how long you go without wins. Even like a guy like Vlasov, he hasn't won in a little while. So how can we create situations which will help him get back to that? So, yeah, that'll be ours, and we've been building it in the background, but I'm pretty excited to see it going, and hopefully we can win Milan-Torino, for example, next year.
Is it also something you implemented or a group implemented in Ineos the last year? Because it kind of feels like Ineos did like a shift as well in the last years, like focusing not on smaller races, but like give them more importance and like actually winning much more races and racing more aggressive.
Yeah. So like so 2025, it was pretty average end of season. Like, I think the last bike race that was actually won was like Pippo in Austria, I feel like. And then it felt like we were really like just trying to claw our way to the end of the season. So one of the projects that Scott Draw is the performance director there, kind of gave me the keys and the DS group was the race philosophy, or racing identity, he called it, which was a really cool thing because we could kind of look at where and how races were won, And then I took it to the, or we took it to the writer group and presented some statistics and some stuff around, like how races are won nowadays. And then basically they had this discussion in kind of three groups of what they wanted their race philosophy to be. And in the end, it came out with like six kind of lines. And then we went into the detail of, you know, what does that look like in action? And, definitely one of those things, I won't reveal any of them, but one of them was like that they race to the line at every bike race, you know, that they're fighters. So I think this year there was just, especially the start of the season, there was a real desire to just fucking build some momentum, you know, and I felt like, I'm personally really proud of what those guys were able to do, especially in the first part of the season. I thought that it was a real shift compared to 2025 in the second half. And I hope that, my contribution to that was felt.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it was super exciting to see the team this season racing, you know, all those, even guys that you thought they're maybe a little bit over their prime, you know, like Kwiatkowski, he was back on fire. It was nice to see, the team in general, like just having a different style than this SkyTrain philosophy they had, you know, with Froome and Wiggins, where they were all like, okay, we have this one big leader and we race like machines. And now it was more, pure racing again, I would say. It was not, I mean, there was probably a strategy behind it, but it just looked like, hey, we're going to just race it out, you know.
Sometimes not. For example, Liège, I wasn't really sure about those two guys going off the front. But I think that's also okay, you know, like this is kind of, there's a football coach in Australia, he talks about like failing your way to success, you know, and I think if you're too conservative and too scared, then you've already lost half the battle. So I think, as I said earlier, like not being afraid to make mistakes is also fine.
Okay, I've got a closing question. I think maybe you could be one to remember a good story, because when we asked this story, the younger riders who now are on the podcast more and more don't know how to answer because they don't bonk anymore. Can you remember your biggest bonk in your cycling life?
I always tell people I did 1.5 tours because I didn't finish when it came close to Girona. And I had like a saddle sore. My only tour with Bora, I'd finished the tour with NetApp with Vossi. And on the Tourmalet stage, like I just couldn't really pedal. And I think I just stopped eating, and the Tourmalet, I must have taken 2 hours to go up the Tourmalet, like, and then I was all alone and missed the time cut by 40 seconds. And I remember that day for forever. Like I thought I was never going to get off that mountain. I think Emu was third on the stage, right, Bossy?
This stage with it. Yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
Yeah, so this day, I think this was probably part of the realization that I wasn't very good. It took me to 2018 to really realize, but that day I'll never forget.
But you know the saying in cycling, a good rider never makes a good sports director. You have to be, you know, an average rider to become a good sports director. Maybe there's a truth to it, you know. We would see.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to listen to Valentino Rossi tell me how to go around a corner on a motorbike, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right. I'd say thank you for your time. And we are curious for the season with Red Bull.
Yeah, let's see. Let's see how it goes. Bit of work to be done yet first, but yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, really good to get to know you. I didn't have any clue. And I already can say it's sympathetic first impression.
Yeah, he's all right.
He's all right.
He's all right. He's all right.
I can be a real prick, probably.
Yeah. I'm you arriving here when? Next week or on Mallorca?
Saturday, yeah. Saturday I'm there for a couple of weeks, so.
Oh, okay, yeah. Nice. Yeah, I'm on Mallorca until next week, so maybe
yeah.
I drop you a message or something.
Yeah, sounds good. I'm getting my bike, so I'm going to get back out of the bike.
Oh, nice.
Nice.
I think you're too fast to me now, bossy.
Probably.
All right, perfect.
I'm coming too. We can do a ride together.
Yeah, that's it. Group pedal gang. Arctic Race after party crew.
Yeah. Zach, thank you for being on the podcast today, and hopefully we will see you back here soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Bye.